All right. Well, it's good to be with you all. So a great introduction to what I was going to talk to you about today, because I was going to tell you about a situation where I got lost once in a parking lot, since we're talking about parking lots. So one time back when I was a young adult, I was at Disneyland with a whole bunch of my friends, and another friend came to join us. And I wanted to make sure she didn't have to drive home from Anaheim alone, so I offered to go with her in her car. And so after the fireworks, we went out to the parking lot. So if you're as old as me, you know that Disneyland didn't always have really nice parking structures. They actually had a really flat, acres-long, you know, lot that just had thousands and thousands and thousands of cars in it. And so when you go out there in the dark, you had to know exactly which Disney character you were supposed to look for. And she had no idea. She had not looked at any of them when she got out of her car. She had just been anxious to join us. And so we get out to the parking lot, and we're just going around in that tram thingy around and around. And then we got out, and we're walking up and down these, like, endless aisles for miles. And it was about midnight before the parking lot finally starts to thin out. And we look, and she sees something that jogs her memory. She sees this giant scaffolding electrical tower. It looks like kind of the Eiffel Tower. And it's the only structure in the middle of a flat lot that goes for acres. And she goes, oh, I think I parked right by that thing. And indeed, she did. So we walked over to that one structure, the one landmark in the middle of the parking lot, and there was her car. So the point that I want to make for this is that it's a really fitting description of our Christian life, because you can't get back when you're lost if you don't know where you're starting from. So sometimes we wander away in our Christian life, and we need to get back to a landmark, back to a place where we can get our bearings in Christ again. And so this morning, we're going to move forward with God's story in Genesis, and we're going to see Abram wander away from the land he was called to, and then come back and start again. Remember when last week, when Mike was talking about Genesis chapters 12 and 15, he was talking about the covenant, the promise that God made with Abraham for a land, offspring, or seed, and that they would be a blessing to the whole earth. Well, part of that promise was land, a land to call home, a land that's full of dirt and rocks and trees and maybe some rivers running through it, a land that you can find on a map in the Middle East if you look. Yes, all of that, but also much more than just a patch of ground. Augustine rightly claims there are two kinds of blessing, temporal and eternal. Things that are now and things that are a shadow of future realities. Land now was part of God's initial blessing to humans before the fall, and it's something that we look forward to having restored after in the new heaven and the new earth described in the book of Revelation. Very real land. But on another level, the promise of land is ultimately a promise of the fullness of living in God's kingdom, what one commentator calls God's people in God's place under God's rule. God's people in God's place under God's rule. And that's available both here and now, yes, and in its truest sense, it will be in eternity. So Abram was promised land under the rule and protection of God. So we have to wonder, we have to ask ourselves why the very next thing in chapter 12 does, right after that grand audience with God, is he leaves the land for Egypt. He leaves for Egypt, a place that so often in the Bible represents self-reliance and oppression and even slavery. So listen to what happens next. In Genesis 12, starting in verse 10, we're going to look through the story in big sections today, so I'm just going to have you stay seated. So hear the word of God. Genesis chapter 12, verse 10 starts, "Now, there was a famine in the land. So Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. When he was about to enter Egypt, he said to Sarai, his wife, I know that you are a woman beautiful in appearance. She's in her 60s, people. And when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. Then they will kill me, but they will let you live. Say you are my sister, that it may go well with me because of you, and that my life may be spared for your sake. When Abram entered Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. And when the princes of Pharaoh saw her, they praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And for her sake, he dealt well with Abram, and he had sheep and oxen and male donkeys, male servants, female donkeys, and camels. But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. So Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say she's my sister so that I took her for my wife? Now then, here is your wife. Take her and go. And Pharaoh gave men orders concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. See, there was a crisis, a famine, an opportunity to trust that God had a plan in the land he had called him to. But he wandered off course. Instead, he tried to solve things on his own. He takes his wife and his nephew Lot, and he heads down to Egypt. And in doing so, he trades food insecurity for something far worse, especially for his wife. But even in this mess that Abram created for himself and his family, God, who rules everything in all of his mercy, stepped in to keep his promise. He used a plague on Pharaoh's household to get him back to Canaan. And that takes us to the end of chapter 12. That's backstory that we're going to need to understand how Abram is able to get to a place of trust. We're going to see Abram face yet another crisis, another opportunity to stay in the place of God, under the rule of God, instead of relying on himself. So what I want us to answer today is this. How do we get back to the place of God under the rule of God when we've gone down to our own private Egypt of self-rule and self-preservation? And I'm going to give away the answer. It's the most important thing I'm going to say all morning. It's one word. It's the way we get back to the place of God under the rule of God. And it is worship. Worship. We're going to see the evidence for that in chapter 13. So let's look at how worship takes us back to the place of God. Chapter 13, 1 through 4. So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the Negev. Now Abram was very rich in livestock, in silver, and in gold, and he journeyed on from the Negev as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai, to the place where he had made an altar at the first. And there Abram called upon the name of the Lord. You see, first, he went back to the place where he last called on God. He went back to Bethel. He found his tower in the parking lot. Back to the beginning, back to the place he had last set up an altar, and there he worshiped God and he called on his name again. Bethel literally means house of God. This is where Abram had been worshiping the Lord just before he went to Egypt in chapter 12, verse 8, just before he got derailed. Just before he turned from trusting God to trying to figure out life on his own. So I want to ask us, me and you, have we been trying to figure out life on our own lately? So when we think back over the last year, the pandemic threw our normal out the window. right? So we've all been living under things that we never expected to live under. The virus, the economic issues, racial tension revisited in a big way, immigrants desperate for help, political conflicts, and all of these things stirring up conflict between friends and family in our own homes. We have had a lot of crisis. Every crisis has come with a temptation to try and take care of it on our own, a temptation really to wander down to our own private Egypt. But for us, the place we're wandering around is in here, isn't it? It's in here. Maybe you felt lost and alone and disengaged from God over the last year, but here's the good news that we get from the story. You don't have to travel for days like Abram to get back to Bethel. Your head is attached to your heart and the rest of you. You can offer your worship, your life to Jesus, right where you are. You can get back to your place of worship because you have the altar with you all the time. Romans 12, 1 and 2 says, I appeal to you, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. It says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. See, maybe to stay in that place, what you need now more than ever is to be surrounded by people who are worshiping with you. And that is exactly what we've come here to do today together. And so we are glad you're here, whether you're here on the patio, you're at home, or you guys back in the sanctuary. Take advantage of opportunities to stay engaged in worship with your church family. Get yourself in a home group. Get yourself in a gathering group or a practice group. Or this summer, show up at youth group. Or serve together in your home group, people in Christ's name. However you do it, get back to your Bethel, back to that tower in the parking lot. Worship takes us back to the place of God. And then here's what you'll find when you get there, when you do. This is our second point, that worship grounds us under the rule of God. The rule of God means we recognize that he is the one that's able and in charge, and we can rest knowing that whatever is going on, whatever chaos is happening, he's got it covered. So let's look again at Abram's example, starting at verse 5. Here we have yet another crisis opportunity. Verse 5, and Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them dwelling together, for their possessions were so great that they could not dwell together. And there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. At that time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites were dwelling in the land. See, this time, in this crisis, we see another kind of food insecurity. The animals they acquired in Egypt eat a lot. I don't know if you got to see it, but a couple weeks ago, we had flocks of sheep. They were over on the other side beyond the parking lot, and we had hired them to eat down the mustard grass and all the other things growing from shoulder high down to stubble, and they did it in a matter of days. Those sheep eat a lot. Well, a lot of animals and a shortage of resources is causing tension between Abram's family and his nephew, Lot. And this time, though, we see Abram coming from a place of connected worship, making decisions grounded in his relationship with God. He won't always do that. He's going to go back and forth. But this time, we're going to see him act out of trust. Look at Abram's solution to the conflict. It's in chapter 13, verse 8. Then Abram said to Lot, let there be no strife between you and me and between your herdsmen and my herdsmen, for we are kinsmen. Is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you take the left hand, I'll go to the right, and if you take the right hand, then I will go to the left. Abram is trusting that God will honor his land promise, no matter what part Lot takes. He lets him choose first, instead of demanding his own right really to it all. Maybe his mistakes in Egypt and his renewed trust in God have transformed him a bit. See, he's not acting out of scarcity anymore. Instead, he's being generous. He's not demanding his own way, his own rights, but he's trusting God to make it work out according to God's plan. And what I take from this is that God, when we trust him, enables us to be generous. One of the early church fathers, Leo I, talked about God's provision this way. He says, "Those who don't stop giving will always be supplied with means to give. We must use what each year gives us in godly works. Difficult seasons must not hinder our Christian generosity. For the Lord knows how to replenish the widow's jars, how to turn water into wine, how to satisfy 5,000 hungry persons with a few loaves." Isn't that a good word for us? What a good reminder. The Lord has all the resources under his command. So rooted in an attitude of worship, Abraham and we are able to trust God and be generous. Okay, now in contrast, let's see what happens with Lot's life. If we look at verses 10 through 13. "And Lot lifted his eyes and saw that the Jordan Valley was well watered everywhere like the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. So Lot chose for himself all the Jordan Valley, and Lot journeyed east. Thus they separated from each other. Abram settled in the land of Canaan, while Lot settled among the cities of the valley and moved his tent as far as Sodom. Now the men of Sodom were wicked, great sinners against the Lord." See, when Abram gave Lot a chance to choose where to settle down, verse 10 says, "Lot lifted up his eyes and saw." Well, what did he see? He saw good-looking, well-watered land, something that looked like the Garden of Eden, but something that also looked like Egypt. It's interesting. He said it looked like the place he just came from, Egypt, the place where he never should have been, the place where people like Sarai were being abused while he got rich. He wanted what he'd gotten used to, his own private Egypt. Verse 11 lets us in on his plan for making big decisions. Note what it doesn't say. It doesn't say Lot stopped and built an altar and worshiped the Lord and asked him where he should go. Quite the opposite. It says specifically, "So Lot chose for himself." The tragic irony here is that Lot puts himself in the kind of danger that he and Abram just came out of. And he misses the opportunity to let God lead him. He actually moves outside of the promised land and next door to disaster. See, it doesn't take long before Lot isn't just over the hill from evil. He moves right in and hangs up his towels. Look where Lot is when Sodom gets raided by an army in chapter 14, starting verse 11. "So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their provisions and went their way. They took Lot also, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way." How to get out of it? Looking down at verse 14. "When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan." So the choice Lot made without God got his whole family taken captive, and Abram had to come to their rescue. If Lot had asked God before he made that decision, maybe he could have avoided a lot of heartache for himself and for his family. Okay, so back to while Lot is choosing for himself, what is Abraham doing? Go back to chapter 13. Starting at verse 14. "The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, 'Lift up your eyes and look, from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land that you see, I will give to you and to your offspring forever. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth, so that if one can count the dust of the earth, your offspring also can be counted. Arise and walk through the length and the breadth of the land, for I will give it to you. So Abram moved his tent and came and settled by the oaks of Mamre, which are at Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord. Okay, what I want you to notice in verse 15 and 16 is that it's God doing the giving. For all the land that you see, I will give it to you. I will make your offspring as the dust of the earth. Back in verse 11, Lot chose. But here, grounded in worship and under God's rule, God is doing the giving and he's doing the making. And one more thing that we should notice about worship in this chapter is it's both how Abram got back to the place of God and trusted in him under the rule of God, but it's also the way that his family begins to be a blessing to all the families of the earth. In verse 18, he pitches his tent by the oaks of Mamre and worships God. Why is that important? Well, groves of trees at that time were spiritual pagan places of worship. Could you imagine people worshiping nature? Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Abraham went and worshiped by those oaks, and he built an altar there. And in doing so, he was pointing the people to another hope, another truth, the one true God. Already, he's beginning to experience what God said, that through him, all the nations of the earth would be blessed. He's a witness to the goodness of a right relationship with God. He is a shadow of the ultimate blessing, Jesus. His offspring thousands of years later would be when Jesus would offer himself on the cross so that all of humankind could be the people of God, in the place of God, under the rule of God forever, the ultimate blessing to all the families of the earth. So I think that you and I can see ourselves in this story. We can all relate to making the best decisions we can with the judgment that we have and then ending up somewhere that maybe we weren't meant to be, off track. Have you been off track lately, trying to handle all these crises in life on your own? Come back to your place of worship, back to the place of rest in Jesus, who loves you and has a good plan for your life in his kingdom. So, church, let's continue to bless others by representing God well, right here in Santa Barbara, through our trust in his sovereignty, trust that grows with our own generosity. And through us, the world will be blessed as well.